March 3, 1946. Spent afternoon with Carl Dönitz. He is polite, affable, in a half-suspicious way, speaks fairly perfect English, but must be given his own reins or he shuts up with mouth firmly compressed. I inquired after his health. He asked me to be seated, made room on his cot for me. We talked of his rheumatism, which is particularly annoying in his left wrist. There is a slight swelling of the left wrist compared with the right, but no marked difference. He asked what I thought of the trials, and I said that I had been rather busy in the past few days and had not attended the sessions regularly. The past week's sessions have been concerned mainly with the indictments against the various organizations.
"Your Judge Francis Biddle," said Dönitz. "He sees clearly, very clearly. Did you hear him ask the prosecutors all those questions?"
I replied that I had heard some. Dönitz is very impressed with Biddle, who he says towers above the rest of the judges.
"He has that little smile about his lips," he said, "when he is listening to something that is questionable. An admirable man. Very fair and sharp."
I responded that Biddle was an excellent man, was one of the Roosevelt cabinet. I made that remark quite pointedly, as there had been some talk of bringing anti-Roosevelt propaganda into the defenses when they get started next week. Dönitz liked particularly the question Biddle asked Justice Robert H. Jackson about how far the responsibility for criminal acts would go in the event the organizations were found criminal. Dönitz feels it is very dangerous to make these organizations criminal because so many thousands of people belong to them, and every German had at least a relative belonging to the SA, SD, SS, and so forth.
"You know what your General Lucius Clay said. He said that should this tribunal find the organizations guilty, he must immediately arrest 500,000 Germans.
I replied that I had not been aware of General Clay's statement, but that Justice Jackson had made it quite clear that he did not intend for all members of these organizations to go on trial, but that the leadership and certain individuals be brought to justice. This point was ignored by Dönitz, as it is ignored by Baldur von Schirach and Wilhelm Frick, and the others to whom I have spoken in the last few days. We talked of many things. Dönitz's plans for the future, for instance, consist of,
"I will get myself a little room and isolate myself with my wife, and I will write my memoirs. I think I should do this for the German people, so they can see for themselves what things went on, and how little those of us in the leadership knew about Hitler and Heinrich Himmler's atrocities."
"It's hard for an American to understand," said Dönitz, "but the watchword of Hitler was,
mind your own business and just do the job you have."
Therefore, Dönitz knew nothing about plans for an aggressive war, nothing about extermination of the Jews, nothing about the plans for extermination of 30 million Slavs, nothing of the atrocities in Russia and Poland.
"I do know that the Russians did the same things when they went through East Prussia."
I challenged this by asking how he knew this and what evidence he had. He admitted it was not first-hand information, but that much had been carried in the Nazi press about Russian atrocities, and some of it was undoubtedly true. He feels he has had a hard life. He was in the last war, and at its end was a lieutenant in the submarine division. He remained in the Navy all through the years. He went all over the world, but strangely, never went to America. He feels this was unfortunate, and he would have liked to see the United States. He has been to Japan and all around the globe. From 1918 until he was summoned by Admiral Erich Raeder in 1935 to reorganize the submarine service, he served on cruisers and other naval craft. It was a tough assignment, and one he was quite surprised to get. He remarks on Raeder's telling him he was in charge of submarines and submarine training. He had been out of touch with submarine developments for so long, and there were only young men in the Navy, and he had to brush up on the whole subject. From that time forth, he was in submarines daily.
"It wasn't good for my rheumatism," he said, "to be in dampness, oil, and water all the time."
Until 1943, he saw Hitler once every 2 years. After 1943, he saw Hitler twice a month. In the last few months, he was in frequent contact with the Führer. When he was informed that the latter had committed suicide and he had been chosen as Hitler's successor as chief of state, he decided to sue for peace
at once, which I did.
I said that if I recalled the radio correctly at the time, it was announced at first that Germany would surrender to the British and Americans, but not to the Russians. He assented. It was just a token gesture, he said. He knew it was impossible. He did not consider himself Hitler's successor. He felt that he had been selected to sue for peace and arrange the surrender, because only a non-political figure could do it. That was the reason he accepted the designation as Hitler's successor as chief of state. I asked him what he thought of the Führer principle. He said he had never been in favor of it, because a man always needs a corrective. That is why a chief of state needs a chief of staff and other advisors. Did he oppose Hitler in any way, by any actions or expressed opinions? No. He was a man of the sea, and that was all.